D-Maze Fingan and Donick, 102.5-106.3 The Game, broadcasting from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Fingan here with you on Wednesday afternoon, and joined as we are every Wednesday at 1 o'clock by Mitch Light of The Athletic to discuss college football. Mitch, a fantastic game on Saturday between Georgia and Alabama. It certainly didn't look like it was going to be a fantastic game, but Georgia did make it a fantastic game in the second half. What did we learn about Alabama and Georgia in that game moving forward in the college football season?
They can both look absolutely incredible. And I think for Georgia, we saw their flaws. I was shocked how poorly they played in the first half. That obviously you credit Alabama. But Carson Beck, you know, I've never been in that position trying to play football, but he looked like a quarterback who's making his first start on the road, which obviously he wasn't. Just was not seeing. I've talked to some people who were like at the game, you know, the press box just didn't look like he was seeing the field very well. You know, sometimes you see a 28-0 score and there's some fluky things, you know, blocked punt or something like that. There's nothing fluky about that. Alabama had guys wide open. Jalen Milroe was fantastic. It looked like no chance that Georgia would come back. And, you know, I know human nature sets in, and when you have the big lead, you're going to change your philosophy defensively, all that stuff. But still, you know, give a ton of credit to Georgia coming back. Thought they had that game won. And then going back to Carson Beck, as well as he played in the second half, he missed some throws late. You know, people talk about the interception, but I think two plays before that or three plays, he had a guy wide open. I forgot who it was, down the left sideline, and just overthrew him. Or underthrew him, excuse me, and the play was broken up. Could have had a touchdown right there. So, you know, clearly two of the most talented teams in the country, and they just put on a great show for us.
So in a few weeks' time, Alabama will travel to Knoxville to take on the Volunteers in another big game. But before Alabama can get to Knoxville, they have to come to Nashville, and they'll play Vanderbilt on Saturday on West End. And earlier I was watching First Take, and they had a segment with their betting analyst, Joe Fortenbaugh, and he took the points for Vanderbilt against Alabama. I believe the spread is 23. And Fortenbaugh's rationale was, as I just said, coming off of a big win for Alabama, number one team in the country. Tennessee is a couple of weeks away. Maybe they're ripe for a letdown. Like, I don't think they're going to lose, but it might be closer than people anticipated. Stephen A. Smith and Chris Russo were incredulous that Joe Fortenbaugh would suggest that Vanderbilt can cover on the points at plus 23. What are your thoughts on that? Could Vanderbilt make that happen?
My thoughts are that I would never listen to anything that Chris Russo, and I grew up in New Jersey listening to Chris Russo, Mike and the Mad Dog, or Stephen A. Smith said about college football. So
that's fair. That's fair.
I don't think either one of those guys are watching a lot of games, college football.
I don't think exactly. I think the rationale is good. If you're looking Vanderbilt with the points, the thing that would play into that, and Clark Lee has said this, I think he said it on his, someone tweeted that he said it on his radio show. They want to limit possessions. Like, I forgot what the number was. They want X amount of possessions in the game. So, like, obviously, the fewer possessions, the fewer points. So the keys to that are turnovers. Vanderbilt has only turned the ball over one time this year, I believe, in their first possession of the Georgia State game on a strip sack. You know, got hit and then fumbled. So they cannot turn the ball over and give the short field. I know different scenarios, but Willie will remember this. When Vanderbilt played Alabama last, when Vanderbilt had a decent team, CBS, whatever, came here like 8, 6, 7 years ago with Kyle Shermer, third play of the game, deflected pass, interception. And it was just like, boom, ball game. You just sensed it right there. Vanderbilt has to protect the ball. And this is another easier said than done. They can't limit the big plays. And I was actually at Clark Lee's press conference yesterday, and he talked about that, just how you defend them, and you got to make them grind it out. You cannot give up the 70-yard play. Georgia did. Georgia gave up some big plays there. So, you know, Vanderbilt has played relatively well on offense this year. And again, they've taken care of the ball, and that's just of paramount importance when you're playing in Alabama.
We'll talk with Mitch Like of The Athletic discussing everything college football. Now, I don't know how big of an upset it was, but I just keep looking at it, and I'm thinking, like, man, this is the one opportunity you had, and you blew it. Lane Kiffin, Ole Miss, at home, and you lose to Kentucky. Listen, Kentucky's not a bad team. They're a good team, but you expect it. It was almost as if Ole Miss went all in this season. They got their portal guys. They went all in this season. It was, you know, fantasies of a national championship, and they still may just make the playoffs. I'm not saying that they're not. But how big of a loss was that this weekend at home?
You hit it, Derek. I mean, it's just deflating. I mean, when you – the all-in part, everything you said was true there. And that's just – with all due respect to Kentucky, which is obviously a very good team, very good defensive team, if you're Ole Miss and you want to do what you want to do this year, you have to win that game. And, you know, we all know Ole Miss, I think they still might actually be leading the nation in a bunch of offensive categories. Well, when you do it against the teams they played, you don't really find out about yourself. And they've had some issues on the offensive line, and Kentucky got after Jackson Dart and pressured him. And, Kentucky, you know, these games are decided by sometimes one big play, and Kentucky made a huge play on a fourth down and won that game. So the beauty of college football in 2024 is you can lose a game like that and still make the playoff. But when you look at – when you're in the SEC and you have a schedule like that, you cannot lose at home to a team that is not in that – quote-unquote upper tier there. So damaging loss, and we'll find out how they regroup. We'll find out a lot about that locker room. I mean, you've been in far more locker rooms than I have, Derek, but you know, in this age of the transfer portal, when you got a lot of new guys, it's great when things are going well and everyone's on the same page. But when you have that setback, how do you react? I'm really interested to see how they react this week in a road game against South Carolina, a team that beat the team that just beat them.
Now, contrary to that, Coach Sanders in Colorado, they're quietly just going about their business and they're winning football games. Can they possibly, looking at their schedule, at the beginning of the season, we thought it was going to be a daunting schedule. Utah has lost since, and it just doesn't seem like the Big 12 is as strong as we thought it could possibly be. Can Colorado find themselves in the playoffs? Or can they run the table from here on out? I know they got a few tough games here and there with the remainder of the schedule. But is this one of the teams that ultimately can find themselves in the college football playoffs?
First, I want to say that was a really impressive performance. I saw a lot of the UCF game, and I thought UCF would win that game with their rushing attack. I thought their physicality, the line of scrimmage, but it was the other way. You know, Colorado found a way to run the ball successfully, and they committed to the run really for the first time all year, and that was just a thorough beat down there. Couple things, you know, they're off this week and they get Kansas State. I think we'll learn a lot more with Kansas State coming to town. That's one of the upper tier teams. A lot of it's going to be Cam Rising's health, and it's become a weekly thing almost for 2 years. If Cam Rising is healthy and can return to his previous form of like 10 years ago, they're probably the best team in the league. But if he's not, if they're forced to go with Isaac Wilson, a true freshman, then they're not. And this is a league where there's so much parity. You can win it at 6-3. So that's why, like, I still think UCF's a good team. So, like, beating them, they've got the head-to-head with them. You know, there could be, like, a four-way tie for 6-3. So I can't believe I'm saying this. You know, if you would have asked me with about 10 seconds to go in the Baylor game, if you would have said, could Colorado win the Big 12? You'd say, no way. But right now, the way they played last week and the way they committed to run the ball, I do think they can contend for a Big 12 title.
Mitch Light is with us from The Athletic. We're talking college football. Mitch, a philosophical question here. I remember back during the college baseball postseason, we were talking about one of the things we noticed during the year is some of the great transfers who really elevated programs, and let's use Kentucky baseball as an example, that went to the College World Series. Some of the people that transferred in from the portal were not these sexy guys who came over from Tennessee or USC or Arizona State, teams like that. They were coming from no-name schools, but they were the right guy. I think of Diego Pavia in this way as well. But what are you noticing as a trend of the art of, and all these teams are now hiring GMs, right, for this type of thing. But what's the trend in college football on how to find the right guys for the portal? Because like Derek was saying, a disastrous thing that can happen is you pay all this money for guys, it's not working, and that can just destroy your locker room and just unravel your whole season. So you have to be smart on how you do it, and it's not obvious sometimes who the best people are to get out of the portal.
Yeah, Florida State's an example of what you're saying. You know, just some issues there. And so I literally was just in a meeting with two other fellow editors because we're kind of plotting our our plans going forward and how we're covering the transfer portal. And that's what you're like. It's so much of it is about fit and finances and finding the right guy for the right NIL price. And there's so many guys that are, oh, this guy didn't play at Georgia. He couldn't play at Georgia, and he transfers down. And you know what? He still can't play. Or there's the he can't play at Georgia. He transfers down. Oh, they had two other All-Americans at his position. And that's why there are GMs. That's why there are talent evaluators. Like, I could sit in the football office over at a school and be like, oh, yeah, that guy was ranked 120th nationally. He's transferring. Let's grab him. But obviously, you got to see the fit. You got to see what the quote-unquote asking price and all that is. So, yeah, it is. It is, and some schools are in position to be more selective. Other schools are not. They've just got to take this guy and hope it pans out. And, you know, we're seeing this at Notre Dame. You know, I would say the Sam Hartman experience last year, you know, maybe give him a B, B minus. He did some good things, wasn't what they thought. So the Riley Leonard experience right now is a D. Whose fault is that? Is that, like, did Notre Dame fall in love with some clips or a sophomore year when he was really good? Did they not evaluate him properly? Did they not realize, you know, it was almost like an NFL draft pick there. It's like, well, he's got really potential. He's shown some good things. But like when you're at college, you're not, you need that guy to be good right away when you're Notre Dame. And he hasn't been very good. And people are disgruntled there. There's people that give money for this stuff. And when the players aren't panning out, people hear about it.
It's never good to be disgruntled. Yeah. It's never a good thing, disgruntled.
Yeah, and it's not an exact sense. Right, the more you pay does not guarantee success, right?
Yeah, so it's just there is no – and part of the problem is the transfer window is so small. Like, people get recruited for literally 2 and 3 years out of high school. They get recruited out of the transfer portal in 2 or 3 days. Now, there's prior relationships. That's why you hear coaches nowadays like – we do a lot of recruiting coverage, and high school coaches will tell you that. Like, college coaches come in, they are – you got to keep forging those relationships. You might go – there could be a five-star at your school. Let's say you're Vanderbilt, there's a five-star half-hour away in Murfreesboro. I'm just making this up. And you got no chance to get him. You know that. But you're still going to try and forge that relationship because you know what? In 2 years, he might be in the portal, and he remembers that Coach Donick came and watched me play high school basketball when no one else was there and drove through the snow. And that means a lot. So, like, that's so much. That's how you forge relationships and maybe give your staff a leg up because you knew this kid. You're not just taking a shot in the dark on a kid from California that you've never talked to before.
Mitch, Missouri Texas A&M has my attention. And I think about, had Texas A&M played better in the first game, this could be a matchup of two top 10 teams. But now you have the local angle with Marcel Reed giving them some life and some momentum. They're hosting Missouri. And this is their first game since the crazy game against Vanderbilt.
Yeah, I'm with you. One of the more intriguing games. I'm just, from a Missouri standpoint, I'm very interested to see how they react. Like, what's the real Missouri? Is it the team that struggled with Boston College and Vanderbilt at home? It doesn't look nearly as explosive as we thought they would. Or is it the team that's a true top 10 team and it's like, oh, it's Boston College and Vanderbilt. We just survived in advance. Now we're getting to the teeth of our schedule and we're going to play better. I think it's more to the former. Like, I just – something with that offense just lacks explosiveness this year. Texas A&M, Marcel Reed's doing his part. He's doing a nice job, but they're a limited offensive team right now. They've got to keep the possessions down. They don't need to get into a track meet with Missouri because despite what I just said about Missouri, they do with Luther Burden and Brady Cook. They have that big playability. So I think if you're – I like Texas A&M at home. But if this, if I don't like it, if it's like 21-14 at the end of the first quarter, I think Texas A&M needs to limit the possessions and keep the score down.
Mitch, in this trend of, we just got done talking about it, a strategy of getting older players, who might not be as sexy or high five star recruits, but they're older than a lot of guys. You have this 17-year-old for Alabama, Ryan Williams, just lighting it up and doing some really special things. Those two catches he made late are so memorable. I mean, I think I'll always remember where I was watching that game. It was just a really special game. But it got me thinking, how many 17-year-olds play? Like, most of the time when you're a college freshman, you're at least 18. So what's the story with this guy, and how rare is it?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, I was young for my grade, and I was 18. Like, I just turned 18 when I got to college. So, yeah, we see a lot of guys reclassify in college, in recruiting. But usually they're already old. Like they quote unquote redshirted when they were in kindergarten. You know, it was a lot
of kids. You start off older, so you get to college older. Yeah.
So he was age appropriate, and he reclassified. So he is literally like he should. I would say, oh, he should be at his prom. You know, you hate when announcers say that. No, but he literally, from an age standpoint, should be in high school. It's amazing. It really is. And, you know, receivers, one of those positions, and running back, the skill positions that, you know, it's if you can do it, you can play right away. Like, offensive line is just so difficult. We see true freshmen do it, but you don't see 17-year-old, like, true freshmen playing left tackle very often. And to me, it's just like, you know, your body changes and everything changes in your life so much between like 15 and 16, 16 and 17. So like he still has, I'm sure will get stronger, and I don't know if he'll get faster, but he's just, you know, I follow recruiting, and Jeremiah Smith at Ohio State was, we just heard for 2 years, this guy, wait till this guy, he's like the best prospect in 10 years. But then Ryan Williams was starting to get that buzz as well once he reclassified. And remember, he committed to Alabama and then decommitted, and then Kalen DeBoer had to get him back. And that's kind of when DeBoer won over a bunch of Alabama fans. Like, they got Ryan Williams committed back to the program that said, yeah, this guy, he might have been at Washington, he might be like west from South Dakota, but he understands how to recruit in the SEC. And obviously we're seeing him pay dividends. Alabama might have lost that game if they don't have Ryan Williams on their team.
Mitch Light of The Athletic joining us on D-Mace, Vingan, and Donick. Mitch, thanks for joining us. We'll chat next week.
Well, program note, I will not be in town next week. So I will... I'll be overseas. I'll be in Italy at this time next week. So
well, get
like
that
some,
phone plan where you fun. Can where you can make international calls.
It'll be a night call.
I will tell my wife, like, sorry, I got to go talk to the guys for 15 minutes.
You guys are going to be in Venice on the boats, and Mitch is going to be on the horn with us.
On games I didn't even see. You know, usually I can see my way through this stuff, but if I haven't seen anything, I might be
just
a little
more
difficult.
Mitch, don't do it. Don't do it. Forget it. We don't matter. We don't matter. After today,
We'll still call. You just don't have to answer. We'll still call.
One Spartan to another, my wife says thank you.
Well, Mitch, enjoy your vacation. We'll talk to you soon. How about that?
Okay. Sounds good, guys. Take care.
Mitch Light joining us. He used the word disgruntled, which is a word I like to use. You never hear about anybody being gruntled. They're always disgruntled. You ever wonder why that is?
Can you be gruntled?
I don't know if you can't be gruntled. Gruntled everyone's right disgruntled, but they're never gruntled. 615.
So if you're gruntled, that means you're happy?
I guess.
Everything's good.
Yeah, exactly. 615-737-1025. Coming up next, we'll talk about the Predators, who have a preseason game tonight, which you can hear on 1025, 1063, the game. An intriguing roster battle as the regular season approaches. We'll touch on it next. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vinkin, 1025, 1063, the game.
Oh, my God. The Braves just gave up a two-run homer.
And Lindor gets under one to center field. Harris going back near the wall. And it's out of here. Linsanity again. Francisco Lindor flips the script with a two-run homer. And the Mets go in front 8-7.
We want it now. The meatloaf. The meatloaf.
Nick Frazier playing that for Jared Stillman, who's sitting back there. Jared's Braves are down 1-0 in their series with the San Diego Padres, while Willie's Mets are up 1-0 in their series against the Milwaukee Brewers. Mets at Brewers, 6:30. Braves at Padres, 7:30 for you baseball fans out there.
We'll see if the Braves can regroup. They've got their money pitcher going. They've had a day to acclimate. Max Fried, I feel like the Braves can get it done.
Yeah, as we said at the top of the show, yesterday's game felt like a schedule loss for the Braves, considering everything that they've had to do for the past few days. But also coming up tonight at 6 o'clock, coverage here on 102.5, 106.3, the game, the Predators preseason continues against the Carolina Hurricanes. Hard to believe, one week from tomorrow, don't show up to Bridgestone Arena next Wednesday for a hockey game. There won't be a hockey game. 1 week from tomorrow, the Predators open the regular season at home against the Dallas Stars. We'll be at Bridgestone Arena for that game, looking forward to it. But there is an intriguing roster battle happening with the Predators. They're going to have to whittle down their roster a little bit more before opening night. The season actually starts on Friday with some of those European games. The Sabres and the Devils are in Prague, just like the Predators were a couple of seasons ago. So the regular season actually starts on Friday, but most of the games start, you know, next week, including the Predators. But there's an interesting battle happening on the back end. Spencer Stastny, the young defenseman, who would have been, fair to say, a shoe-in for the opening night roster had he been in training camp?
I think, I don't know about shoe-in because he is...
Safe bet? How about a safe bet?
I think it would have been a good bet because of just what he has shown when he's been in there. Now, I will say this. He's still at the stage of his career. He could be sent to Milwaukee yes. without waivers, which is always something to be wary of at this time because of everybody. You want to keep as many of your guys in the fold as you can. So that would be the only thing that would have told me that he might not have made the opening night roster. But I think it would have been his spot to lose. But now he has not been available because of a personal issue that they have not really defined what it is. But he hasn't been there the whole camp.
That's a good way of putting it, his spot to lose. So now that Stastny is unavailable for an undetermined amount of time, it opens the door for someone like Tanner Molendijk to potentially make the Predators' opening night roster. And the situation with Molendijk is interesting because of his age and where he's been playing. He's been playing junior hockey in Canada. He's 19 years old. And if I have this correct, so the Canadian Hockey League is the umbrella organization that represents the major Canadian junior leagues. And they have an agreement with the NHL about players of a certain age, I believe under 20 players, that basically it boils down to this. If Molendijk does not make the Predators roster out of training camp, he must go back to junior and spend his entire season in junior. He then could, when that season is over, theoretically join the Milwaukee Admirals and play in the American League. But if he does not make the Predators out of training camp, he must return to junior. He cannot be sent to the American League. He can't play for the Admirals until his junior season is over. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Molendijk. The Predators are high on this kid. It'll be interesting to see if he does make the team out of training camp. A recent example of this for the Predators was Sam Girard in 2017. Same situation. He made the team out of training camp. He played a handful of games with the Predators. He was ultimately traded to the Colorado Avalanche in the deal that landed Kyle Turris in Nashville. But that's the other thing that the Predators could do. They could play Molendijk up to 9 games before sending him back to junior without burning a year off his entry-level contract. His contract would slide a year. So with Stastny unavailable, Molendijk is a player who they have 3 preseason games left, tonight, Saturday, and Monday in the makeup game from last week because of the Hurricane, not the Carolina Hurricanes, but Hurricane Helene. Tanner Molendijk is probably the player with the most to gain over these next 3 games for the Predators.
I think that is something that they have to be weighing, and there's a couple of things to consider with the roster flexibility part of this. You laid it out beautifully, I think.
Thank you.
What a lot of teams do
I'm gruntled by that.
Yeah,
I'm gruntled by that.
Everything's good. We're gruntled. We're not disgruntled.
I'm gruntled.
I have seen teams, I think everybody could probably think of some examples, where they feel like a guy has dominated the junior level.
Which Molendijk has, correct?
More or less, yes. And even last year, there was a lot of chatter. Andrew Burnett and Barry Trotz really liked him at age 18. Now, Tanner Molendijk, just so people know, is a first-round draft pick. They used the first-round pick they got from the Oilers in the Matthias Ekholm trade to draft Molendijk. We know that there are some first-round picks that take 2, 3, 4 years before you really have a chance to make the team, and there's other guys that make a great first impression unexpectedly. He was unexpectedly close to being in the situation last year. They molded over and decided not to do it. He had a really good year in junior, and so I think they are considering the same thing this year. You can spread out the 9 games over as long as you want. You don't have to play him in the first 9 games and then send him back. You could space it out so that he gets a feel for being around the NHL. You get the practices. You get spotted in games that maybe makes sense, and you can string it out a couple of months if you want to. Now, with Stastny out there, you could say they customarily would keep seven defensemen on your opening night roster. You have a maximum of 23. The one guy to consider, though, Mark Delgado would be the next guy up in my depth chart. He is a guy that you would have to waive if you wanted to send him to Milwaukee. Now, you could keep them both, right? You could have Delgado as theoretically your seventh defenseman and Molendijk an eighth, but that means you could only keep one extra forward. So it is a little bit of a puzzle that you have to put together. So I don't know where Andrew Brunette is on this, but I would think in the next two or three, they have three preseason games left. Molendijk might be a guy to watch just to see how he looks, and I'm sure people will be asking about him about this scenario because it's exciting that he's moved up to this point. He is a really fast skater that is working on the skill, but his style seems to fit the Andrew Brunette fast-paced skating system that he has implemented.
It'll be interesting to see what happens there just because the Predators are a team that's built with a lot of veteran players. I'm looking at the current rosters right now, and the Predators' average age, one being the youngest, 32 being the oldest in the NHL. Their average age currently is 28.24. That's 27th. So they are one of the oldest teams in the league. And by the time the season starts and opening night rosters are set, it would not shock me if the Predators were 29, 30, 31 on that list. So, this can relate to any sport. You know, obviously it's important to have veteran players, but think about it like this from the Titans' perspective. How many under 25 difference makers do the Tennessee Titans have?
Well, that was a big theme on the first day of training camp.
Right.
None. Basically. Now, I would say that since the day one of training camp, I think Latham and Sweat are emerging as guys that look like they might hit in that category.
Yeah.
If they keep progressing, I think they're getting onto the radar.
And Derek can speak to this. When you're putting together a team, it's important to have your veteran players, the guys that have been there and done that. But it's also important to inject some youth into that equation. I mean, it keeps the veteran players, you know, spry. It's pushing guys, older guys, for jobs. I can imagine having a young player on the roster. I mean, it's good for the veterans on the team as well to have those whippersnappers pushing for playing time and making things maybe a little bit more interesting.
It keeps them gruntled.
It keeps them gruntled.
Yeah, but I mean, you gotta have. I think you gotta have a good mixture of both veteran guys, guys that have seen a lot of the league, that understands the league, but then you know an influx of young guys because eventually these older guys will be phasing out, whether it's through trade, retirement, or you just release them. They're going to be phasing out. But you want to have that core group of young guys, which I think the Predators do have, core group of young guys that can learn from these older guys. And then when it's their turn, you believe in your scout and everything else that they're going to take that next step once those older guys sort of segue out of it.
What will be interesting if Tanner Molendijk makes the team is which of his Predators teammates is he going to live with? Macklin Celebrini, who was the number one overall pick in the draft over the summer of the San Jose Sharks, is going to be living with Joe Thornton, you know, a legendary NHL player who spent a lot of his career in San Jose, one of the best playmakers of all time, you know, great personality. So I'm wondering if Tanner Molendijk makes the roster, which Predators player is going to open their doors for him. I assume it would probably be another defenseman. Maybe he lives with Luke Shen. Maybe, you know, it's usually families with kids, like young kids, not like babies, but like, you know, 5, 6, 7, you know, maybe it'll be interesting to see if that were to happen, you know, which veteran player steps up and has Molendijk live with them during the season.
One of the most famous ones was Mario Lemieux. Had
Sidney
who was
Crosby,
actually
yes.
owning the team at the time.
Yes.
Of course, legendary player had Sidney Crosby living there. So two of the greatest of all time were living together when one was graduating into ownership and one was just entering the league at 18. As far as the younger players, too, I think you can't say enough about how big this year is going to be for Phil Tomasino and Yusuf Parsonen, who have had, you know, it looks like Tomasino, from what I can gather, has been a little more impactful in this training camp than Parsonen has. If you look at the line combinations in practice the last day or two, it looks like Parsonen is a little bit more on the outside looking in. Both of those players are at critical times in their career in that it's sort of put up or shut up. They're young enough to where they could still make a big breakthrough, but they're also at a point where if you want to send them to Milwaukee, you have to send them through waivers a la Eli Tolvanen, right? This was the stage of his career where the Predators got impatient, they had a roster crunch, and they lost him. So that could happen to Tomasino or Parsonen if they get into a roster crunch. They need other players. Maybe other players are passing them up. So that is something to watch because it's teetering for those guys. They have had moments, right? Just like Tolvanen. If you put in highlights of a particular game somewhere along the line the last couple of years, you will see Parsonen and Tomasino, heroes of the game, first star of the game kind of stuff. But night in and night out, it hasn't happened for them yet. But if either or both hit this year, that gives you that infusion of youth and keeps everybody gruntled, right? That would provide gruntledness.
Yes. And you have to be deliberate about when you place certain players on waivers. You want to do it on a day where there are going to be dozens of other players on waivers. Sort of flood the zone, so to speak.
It is an art form.
Right. You don't want to put someone like Yusuf Parsonen on waivers, for example, when maybe only seven other players are on waivers that day because teams might take a longer look at adding him off the waiver wire versus if they're, let's just say, 40 players around the league on the waiver wire.
But those guys, I think, because of that reason, have to get protected at the beginning of the season. I think those guys have to make the team because you're not going to give up on them before the season starts. And that puts you in a, what do you do with some of the other guys? And I think one of those guys for sure that you would have to think about in those terms is Molendijk.
Steve is on our phone line, driven by Wilson County, Hyundai.com with a Preds comment. Steve, quickly, go ahead.
Yep, I was listening to you guys. Great comments. I'm really excited this year. Correct me if I'm wrong, but looks like maybe the power play line's going to be Forsberg, Yossi, Stamkos, Marchessault, and Ryan O'Reilly.
Yes, that is the expectation.
If we don't score goals, it's not the players, it's the coach. But that I am so excited to see this.
Well, Steve,
so excited. Looking forward to this.
Steve, thanks for the call. Steve speaks for a lot of Predators fans when it comes to that power play. I've said this before. There's a trend around the league with certain teams where they have one power play unit. They technically have two, but they only rely on one. The example I always use is the Edmonton Oilers. Connor McDavid, Leon Draisaitl, Zach Hyman, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, and Evan Bouchard.
Right.
If there is
now,
a second
now this
unit,
would be, what, the second or third year in a row, and I'm pointing this out for a reason, but that fivesome would have been, this will be at least the third year that it's those five.
Second, because I can't remember. I guess Bouchard would have taken over for Tyson Barrie when Tyson Barrie was traded to the Predators.
Fair.
So maybe like year two and a
two
half.
Two and a half. Yeah, two-ish.
So, but like the New York Rangers are another team that does that. I think the Lightning were probably a team that did that with Steven Stamkos.
Right, and you can name the five.
Say
Boston Bruins for
right.
sure. So my point would be you have to, I don't know if it's going to be instant overnight, you know, rise to the top. It's going to take a little time because they're new guys, right? As great individually as they are, and we had a discussion about this before, Adam, but, you know, it's different pieces. Stamkos is going to play in the same spot and try to do the same things that he's done
right.
for over the course of his career, but the other guys have to know where he likes it, when to get it to him. There's a chemistry that a power play has to have, and sometimes you'd be surprised on some guys where look on paper, you name the five names, you're like, how are these guys not in the top five? And they're struggling. Penguins last year, right? And other teams are like, these are the guys that are in the top eight.
No fewer than three Hall of Famers, future Hall of Famers on that power play unit at one time.
And maybe four.
Yes.
Right?
Carlson, Letang, Crosby, and Malkin in some form.
Those four might be Hall of Famers, right? At least three of them are.
At least three.
Letang is borderline, maybe. But you would also look at some other power plays and you go, how are they doing it? These guys are top 10, and the names don't strike you because it's chemistry. It's how the pieces fit. So I think my comment would be allow it to marinate a little bit before you judge it.
615-737-1025. We'll wrap up today, getting back to the Will Levis, Mason Rudolph conversation. A bit of news about that from a prominent NFL insider. We'll get to that next. Adam Vingan, Willie Donick, Derek Mason, 1025-1063. The game. D-Maze, Vingan, and Donick, final segment on Wednesday. Stillman and Company coming up next on 1025-1063. The game. Tomorrow, Silly Underdog Picks at noon. The people won last week. So that could be you if you want to participate. That's tomorrow at noon. I'm sure we'll have a great prize. We've had
some big ones.
Some really good ones. And by the way, I'm 0-5 in the competition. 4-1 in covering the spread. 0-5 in the competition.
No points for a cover.
No, unfortunately not. But of course, the story of the day, probably the story of the next couple of weeks around here, is the Will Levis, Mason Rudolph situation. And Jeremy Fowler of ESPN.com had a note in his weekly notebook with Dan Graziano. And Jeremy Fowler wrote, Monday night was not ideal for Titans quarterback Will Levis, who threw a bad interception, hurt his shoulder, and watched backup Mason Rudolph operate the offense cleanly. But Brian Callahan's declaration that Levis will, quote-unquote, 100% be the quarterback if healthy is not lip service to my understanding. This is something that Willie talked about earlier. Levis, as of now, is not in a quick hook situation, as the Titans seem intent on seeing the Levis experience through. Levis has struggled with mistakes early in the season, but the upside is high. Tennessee needs to see what it has before it pivots. So I don't get the sense that this is a Bryce Young situation, and the bye week gives Levis's shoulder injury time to heal.
I'm a little puzzled. Mm-hmm. Derek, on how right now you could sit there if you're Jeremy Fowler and say the upside is high. What is that based on? Right now, I'm a little concerned that my bar has lowered in my own evaluation. I think it could be higher than it is now, but when you say the upside is high, what's he basing that on?
Because they're listening to what's coming out of the building. They're talking to the people inside the building rather than looking at the film and understanding. The upside isn't high. Now, there may be some upside there because of the strong arm, you know, the frame. That's an upside, but the upside isn't high. That's a lazy way of sort of saying I really didn't, you know, watch film of them. I'm just basically going by what they're saying. And everything that's going to come out of that building is he has a high upside. So watch, wait and see. We're going to give him time.
Right.
Look at his upside. Look at the strong arm. Look at this. Look at that. What Jeremy Fowler should have done was watch film.
Or maybe cross-check it with
exactly.
some other people. Because
absolutely.
Adam, I believe this is how it works. You tell me if
it's
journalistic.
Fowler?
That was Jeremy Fowler.
Jeremy Fowler.
Yeah, Jeremy Fowler.
You tell me if this is how you would see it as a writer. You're a national writer. You make a call to the Titans and say, hey, this is Jeremy Fowler. Can I talk to Rand Carthon or whoever who chooses to be the off the record? You know, I want to put out a report on the Levis. I saw what you said at the press conference. I want some insight. That's kind of how it works, right? So you get the straight shot because there's an interest in the Titans to put out mm-hmm. a vote of confidence for Levis, and that's the message you're going to get, right? That is what happens sometimes, correct?
Yes, and you're talking to some sort of source in the organization that would know these things. You know, it may not be Rand Carthon. Maybe it's Chad Brinker. Maybe it's someone else in football administration that knows about the decision-making. But you're not talking to the security guy for something like this. But to your point, it is in the Titans' interest to sell a story, for lack of a better term, that, hey, Will Levis is our guy. Brian Callahan wasn't just saying that to calm the waters. He really is the guy. But then, of course, you have to dig a little bit deeper, and maybe you touch base with people in other organizations to get a sense of what they think of Will Levis, or you know, it's a tricky balance. Like I joked about this yesterday with the Devontae Adams thing, right? And there are more things that are about that trade. It's like, well, the Raiders could possibly consider thinking about doing this. You know, it's a lot of hedging. You know, it's a very tricky balance when you're in this position, you know, looking for information.
Well, you can't, you know, come out and say he is our quarterback. We'll be back in the star lineup, and then have a report coming out the next day saying, well, they're not too sure about Will Levis after the head coach vehemently said he's our guy.
Well, didn't this happen last year when Will Levis was going to start his first game? Mm-hmm. There were reports maybe from someone like Ian Rappaport that said Will Levis is expected to start against the Atlanta Falcons.
Yeah, and then Vrabel was like,
I never said that.
See, that's the division within the lock, within the building. And they don't want that division anymore. So the message that was put out by Brian Callahan is the same message. If you're asking within that building, it's the same message that's going to be relayed to you. And then you're going to write about it, Jeremy Fowler. Hey, he's the guy. Nothing here. We're moving on with Will Levis. They can't go back on. You know, nobody in that building can say, I'm not sure. Because Brian Callahan already came out and said he's the guy.
We'll continue this conversation as well as others surrounding the Titans, Predators, and more tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Stillman & Company coming up next, 102.5, 106.3 The Game.
Be loved, love on your people. Have a wonderful and blessed Wednesday. Peace.